You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, who's better looking, liberals or conservatives? We'll find out what a new study has to say in just a bit.
First, there's been growing national attention to the issue of civil asset forfeiture. That's when police seize property involved in criminal activity.
Supporters of forfeiture say it's a deterrent to crime. It prevents criminals from profiting from their crimes. And forfeitures can provide a boost to police department budgets.
But a growing number of critics say police seize too much from citizens, that they seize valuable items like cars and houses for lesser offenses. In some cases, assets are seized even when no charges are filed. And there's a concern that allowing police departments to make money from seizures is an incentive to take too much in forfeitures.
A group of Wisconsin lawmakers is proposing legislation that would put new limits on forfeitures here in the state. State Senator David Craig is with us. He's the Republican senator from the town of Vernon in Wisconsin's 28th Senate District. He's co-author of the new legislation. Senator Craig, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
What led you to tackle this issue of a civil asset forfeiture?
Yeah, I mean, it's a movement that's occurring nationally. A lot of states have these laws in the books, and the most glaring thing about the current statute that we have right now, I think, is it's on its face, I think, unconstitutional. So what we have is a situation where an individual might never be charged with a crime nor convicted of a crime, and they could have their property seized and have that property forfeited or liquidated by a law enforcement agency with no real level of due process. And that is a situation which has led to some very, very infamous stories in other states, much less so here, but still some stories of, I think, abusive situations that I think call for the legislature to fix this bad policy that we have on the books.
In the legislation you're working on with your colleagues, what changes? Give us a before and after.
Yeah, so right now, like I said, you need not be charged with a crime. You need not be convicted of a crime. You need not ever necessarily appear before a jury of your peers to have your property taken and forfeited. So what our bill says is that cannot happen. There cannot be any more civil asset forfeiture. It has to be a criminal forfeiture. So we want to make sure that there is a conviction, that the Fifth Amendment is upheld. The Fifth Amendment says that no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, and that's what we want to make sure happens here. So that is really the main thing. There are a couple of other less notable changes that deal with how local law enforcement interact with federal law enforcement and how forfeitures occur. So right now, if there was a local law enforcement that was working on a case where a forfeiture occurred, that forfeiture could be used to a certain extent to recoup costs to the department for creating that forfeiture, but then the rest of that money should go to the common school fund under our constitutional provision of our state constitution. Our bill makes sure that if there is a what they call a federal adoption of a case, so local law enforcement working with federal law enforcement, right now local law enforcement could take a case that they've worked on, give it to a federal agency to have the federal agency prosecute it, and then have the forfeiture from that federal forfeiture turn around and be sent back to the local police department, which we think is not a policy that we should necessarily have on the books right now. We're open to discussing that provision, but we would want to see that money is going to where I think the authors of our Constitution wanted it to go, to the Common School Fund, a more neutral fund that's not attached to the entity that's creating the forfeiture in the first place, so that we're not what they call policing for profit, as it's known in other states. So those are a couple of the provisions of the bill. We have some other changes in legal standards for what the threshold is that law enforcement needs to prove. So what we say is that you have to have a clear and convincing level of information about a piece of property that it was utilized in a crime before that item can be forfeited also, just to make sure that even if there is a conviction, that we're not, there are stories in Wisconsin where whole vehicles that may have been used in fairly petty drug crimes have been forfeited. Is that something that should be done? I don't believe so. Should there be a forfeiture in that case? Quite certainly there should be something. But does, you know, selling a few joints out of a vehicle, does that require, or does that hearken to a full forfeiture of an entire vehicle in the value of thousands upon thousands of dollars? And it might be a source of a person's livelihood in addition to that. So we want to make sure that there's a level of what we call proportionality in the statute.
Right. Does your legislation create a standard for proportionality so that, as you say, $200 worth of drugs offense doesn't lead to the confiscation of a $10,000 car?
Right. And there is proportionality that's in case law. But we wanted to make sure that proportionality is in the statute and that we do address that in this bill.
We're talking to State Senator David Craig. He's working on legislation with colleagues on civil asset forfeiture here in Wisconsin. Now, I want to look at U.S. Attorney General nominee Jeff Sessions. He's one of the people who is in favor of forfeiture. He's been quoted as saying, taking and seizing and forfeiting through a government judicial process illegal gains from criminal enterprises is not wrong. And he said that 95% of these forfeitures involve people who have done nothing in their lives but sell dope. And then we've also heard opposition, or at least concern, from the Wisconsin Chiefs of Police Association. How do you address concerns from, you know, the nation's top lawyer in the near future and the police departments around the state?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably going to be a level of disagreement that I have with the attorney general nominee. But when we talked to law enforcement groups here in Wisconsin, we had public hearing on the bill last session. It became apparent that somewhere in the 90% of forfeitures do have a conviction attached to them. And if that is the case, then I don't see what the resistance to the bill is, because if the vast majority of forfeitures will still occur because they're tied to a conviction, then why would there be opposition to a bill ensuring that is always the case? And that's we do have to be concerned about. We have to be concerned about the Bill of Rights. And even if it is a small portion of the number of forfeitures that occur, we need to make sure that we protect those individuals to make sure that they have had due process before their property is taken. So there may be a level of disagreement. And now, the federal standards are slightly different from the state standards, and I believe the legal standards for attaching a crime to an inanimate object are slightly different than we have here in Wisconsin. We need to worry about what we can do here in the legislature, and this, I just think, is a glaring example of an unconstitutional policy that needs to be addressed by us who have been elected to uphold the Constitution.
As I understand it, in many states, police departments rely on forfeiture for a big part of their budget. Wisconsin is not quite to that extent. That said, would this change leave some gaps in police department budgets?
It may. We've heard anecdotal testimony from police departments that say that there will be, I shouldn't say police departments, but law enforcement agencies, that say that this will inhibit their enforcement. And if there's a little bit of inconsistency, because if there's a conviction that's occurring and the forfeiture is occurring as a result of the conviction, I just don't see what kind of gaping hole there would be in a budget. If there is a budget hole, though, that's something for policymakers to make up for or to find a resolution for. That is not up for the executive branch to gauge levels of enforcement based on the need for filling holes in the budget. I mean, this is why we elect legislators. This is why we elect county board supervisors. This is why we elect city aldermen, to make policy decisions and fiscal decisions for executive branch agencies. That is not something that should be a driving force for our policing policy in Wisconsin.
We've seen calls for similar laws at the national level from people concerned about civil liberties, really on the left and the right. Republican Jim Sensenbrenner at the federal level, for example, is working on this. Do you see bipartisan support here in Wisconsin on this issue?
Oh, we do. I think this is one of those, I guess, somewhat rare issues that unites kind of both ends of the political spectrum. Myself, Steve Nass, have been the leaders in the state Senate and the Republican caucus. Bob Wirch, who's on the opposite end of the political spectrum from Kenosha, is a staunch defender of our bill and is a co-author of the bill. Fred Kessler from Milwaukee on the Democrat side is a staunch defender of our bar changes, as well as Gary Talkin and Adam Jarko, who are more conservatives from the Republican caucus in the Assembly. So this is one of those areas where the left and right agree that something needs to get done in the name of the Bill of Rights and you know, just making sure that individuals have due process rights. I'm happy that both sides can come together on what I think is really common sense legislation like this.
What are you looking at for a timeline on this?
Yeah, so we have it out for co-sponsorship right now. We're getting a lot of interest in it right now. So we're going to be working with our colleagues for the rest of this week to get more and more names on the bill to show the groundswell that is out there right now. I don't see anything happening as far as bill progress goes in the next probably couple of weeks because we have to do some of the more administrative functions. But I'd like to see it get going in a hearing in both bodies in fairly short order and then hopefully signed into law very soon.
Are you optimistic that leadership in both chambers will get on board and let votes happen here?
I think so. Like I said, this has a lot of support on both sides of the aisle. It's good public policy. We all swore an oath to uphold the Constitution. You can't look at the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution and then look at the statute that we have and just let that be. So we're going to have conversations with our colleagues. If there are some that have concerns, we'll work through those concerns. But at the end of the day, we should be engaged in making good public policy here. And this is something where both sides of the political spectrum look at it and say, you know what, something needs to get fixed. So I'm very, very confident that we'll have something done before the end of the session here.
Senator Craig, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
That was State Senator David Craig, Republican from the town of Vernon. He joined us to talk about legislation he co-authored, changing the rules for asset forfeitures by Wisconsin law enforcement agencies.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, President Donald Trump signed his support today for the Keystone XL and Dakota Access pipelines. We'll talk about an environmental policy with an expert about that news.
First, we're not trying to start any fights here, but new research published in the Journal of Public Economics shows conservatives are seen as better looking, at least in the United States, Europe, and Australia.
What's more, voters tend to assume the better looking candidate is the conservative one. And researchers have a theory about why candidates on the right tend to be seen as more attractive.
Anna Swanson joins us now. She's a reporter with the Washington Post Wonk blog. Anna, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, now this does kind of sound like fighting words. Conservatives are seen as better looking, but a new study shows that it might be true. That might be the way people perceive things. Tell us more about what that study found.
That's right. Well, this was a very entertaining and fascinating study, I thought. It was actually done by researchers in Sweden, Germany, and the Czech Republic, but they looked at governments around the world, including in the U.S., Europe, and Australia. And as you described, what they found was that politicians on the right were more likely to be good-looking in all of those places. And, you know, that voters were also clued into that as well, that they used politicians' looks as a kind of cue to learn more about their ideology.
Right. In one of the parts of the study, as I understand it, they'd show pictures of a couple different candidates to voters and not identify anything about them without anything else to choose from. Right. Voters would say they'd look at the more attractive one and think that was the conservative.
Right. So they showed them photographs of political candidates in Finland, as well as U.S. candidates for Senate and governor and the Australian House of Representatives. And of course, there's a lot of variety here, you know, within the samples. There were definitely some better looking liberals and some, you know, not as attractive conservatives. But on the whole, when you compared the two groups, there was a statistically significant difference in attractiveness between the right and the left.
But isn't beauty in the eye of the beholder? I mean, isn't someone's definition of beauty going to vary from person to person?
I think that's true to some extent, but there are, you know, pretty accepted social conventions for what we find beautiful. And I thought this research was very interesting because it falls into a broader category of psychological research that looks at, you know, how people are perceived and the kind of benefits that being attractive can win people in society. And this is something that researchers have called a beauty premium. There's a really fascinating field of research about this. For example, they found that in the workplace, more attractive people tend to be promoted more. They tend to earn higher salaries. In school, more attractive people tend to be more popular, get better grades. And it can even affect something like prison sentences. More attractive people tend to get shorter prison sentences. So there does appear to be some consensus about, you know, who in our society is attractive, and those people do experience substantial benefits.
So what are some of the explanations of why the more attractive people, as defined by society, would end up being conservative politically? And I guess vice versa, why conservative
right.
people would be more attractive?
Yeah, so this is the really fascinating part of the study, I think. So their thesis is that people who are good looking are generally treated better than others. And, you know, because of these things that I described, you know, they earn higher salaries, they are more liked, they're, you know, seen as more popular. They tend to see the world as a more just place than people who are not as attractive. And the researchers suggest that, you know, being more attractive because of that tendency can lead to a lower preference for egalitarianism. So, you know, basically that's a fancy way of saying that, you know, you place less stress maybe on everybody being equal and maybe more stress on something like personal freedoms. So in the U.S. And other countries, a preference for egalitarianism tends to correlate more with leftist or more liberal policies. They have another theory, which is that, you know, being more attractive can also cause you to be wealthier. And when you're wealthier, you have less preference for redistribution, which means that you might favor, you know, something like lower tax rates, for example, and less welfare spending. And so those subtle sort of psychological influences can end up influencing your personal politics.
Well, so is the flip true as well, then, that less attractive people think the world is more unjust because I guess they get treated less fairly, and that leads them into this liberal political route?
The researchers don't really go into that, but I think that that is a reasonable conclusion. There is other psychological research that shows that, you know, people who aren't as attractive might face discrimination. And, you know, the flip side of that, too, I guess, is that more attractive people can have this subconscious bias attributed to them called the halo effect, where, you know, people assume that because they are attractive or beautiful, they also think that they're good or intelligent or trustworthy. So naturally, you know, the opposite side of that would be, you know, less attractive people do face certain, you know, certain challenges or hardships compared to that.
Anna Swanson is with us now. She's a reporter with the Washington Post Wonk blog, looking at some recent research on attractiveness and ideology. Some research finds that conservatives tend to be more attractive, as judged by society anyway. And Anna, you mentioned the beauty premium. People get paid more when they're seen as attractive. Is there an electoral premium? Do people get more votes? Did the research go there if they're attractive?
The researchers did find that, and that was especially true in elections where people tended to not have as much information about the candidates. So, you know, in situations where, you know, basically all you have to go on is a photo and a name, I mean, that's, you know, understandably what you're going to make your judgment on. In situations where you know more about a candidate, know more about their policies, you're probably swayed more by that. But, you know, I think both psychology and kind of popular opinion, you know, does show that people have a preference for more attractive public figures. That doesn't mean that every public figure we have is an attractive person, but it certainly influences how we think and how we vote.
So any word on if someone who identifies as, you know, a liberal or a Democrat, if they're voting between, you know, and say in a primary race, are they also going to vote for the more attractive candidate?
Well, so in elections where voters have a lot more information, you know, like primary elections where you have candidates that are well covered by TV news and in the newspaper, these researchers found that the appearance of politicians ended up mattering equally to voters, regardless of their party or ideology. So, I mean, in a situation like the U.S. primary, where we had all heard so much about the candidates, according to their research, the attractiveness of the candidates wouldn't have been as influential in that situation.
So more knowledge means less attention to what our candidates look like is the conclusion there, right?
That's right. Yes. Mm-hmm. Which is a good thing, I think, right? The more you know
about people
the policies,
in the media business,
the more you
anyway,
would vote
yeah.
on policies. Uh-huh.
And Anna, I, for better or worse, I read the comments section after this article in the Washington Post. It got pretty nasty. What do you make of that? That people are feeling pretty riled up about this and getting into the looks game.
Yeah, well, it's an especially contentious moment in politics right now. So any article really on the Washington Post that mentions politics is probably going to have some fighting in the comments section. And, you know, obviously it is kind of a controversial finding in some way. But I think if you look at their research and at the basic idea, you know, that you know, people who are better looking and have what psychologists, you know, call benefit from what psychologists call a beauty premium, you know, they may tend to see the world as a slightly rosier place, and that could affect their policy choices. That seems like a, you know, fairly reasonable conclusion to me, despite all of the partisan fighting.
And you mentioned this is covering not just the U.S., but also a lot of Europe and Australia. Is there anything that stood out about us Americans, or are we pretty much par for the course in looking at attractiveness of our candidates?
I think we were pretty par for the course. I mean, so for part of the experiment, the researchers looked more specifically at elections in Finland. And they said that those were easier to study because races there, you know, feature a lot of candidates competing for office, whereas in the U.S. you only have two major candidates. So it's a little bit more challenging to look at the difference. But, you know, in other experiments where, you know, for example, they showed people photographs of politicians in the Senate or in the House or in other countries, the trends were fairly similar.
Anna, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Anna Swanson, reporter for the Washington Post Wonk blog. She joins us to talk about a new study published in the Journal of Public Economics that finds conservatives are seen as more attractive.
Coming up, we'll talk to an environmental expert about the news that President Donald Trump signed his support for the Keystone XL and Dakota Access pipelines. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up tonight after 7, it's Latino USA. This week, what remains after you say goodbye? Latino USA looks at different departures from saying adios to President Barack Obama and examining his reputation as the, quote, deporter in chief, to a legendary conga player wrapping up his career. That's tonight after 7 on the Ideas Network.
Now, President Donald Trump signed an executive order earlier today reviving the Keystone XL pipeline that's been the subject of years of debate. The president also signed a document clearing the way for the government to approve the Dakota Access Pipeline in North Dakota. This pipeline led to months of protests when the Standing Rock Sioux tribe came out against construction of the project less than a mile from its reservation.
Here's President Trump as he signed the document in support of the Keystone XL pipeline.
This is with regard to the construction of the Keystone Pipeline, something that's been in dispute, and it's subject to a renegotiation of terms by us. We're going to renegotiate some of the terms, and if they'd like, we'll see if we can get that pipeline built. A lot of jobs, 28,000 jobs, great construction jobs.
The president made similar comments as he signed the document approving the Dakota Access Pipeline.
Michael Kraft joins us now to talk about these pipelines and their role in American energy and the environment. He's an emeritus professor in the Department of Public and Environmental Affairs at UW-Green Bay. A new edition of his book, Environmental Policy and Politics, will be published later this year. Michael, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, any surprise that President Trump, so early in his term, signed his support, tried to get the ball rolling again on these two pipelines?
None whatsoever. I'm surprised it wasn't, a day one announcement. I think Donald Trump made it very clear during the campaign that he favored accelerated production, particularly domestic production of fossil fuels. He indicated relatively little, if any, concern for climate change. And those were the concerns that Barack Obama had. And eventually, after a lot of equivocation, turning against the Keystone Pipeline. And so it's not a surprise Donald Trump, who, it's not real clear, but at some points has called climate change a hoax, and other times said he hasn't made up his mind, but it clearly is not a priority for him. So he wants to accelerate use of fossil fuels, as do most members of his party in Congress.
How important are these pipelines to our energy picture and the environment, as part of their direct impact versus the symbols that they've become in this in energy and environment debate?
Yeah, that's tougher to answer because in many ways, whether we have pipelines or not, we're still going to use oil. We're still going to import oil. Canada, the XL pipeline, of course, a Canadian-U.S. pipeline. If we don't have pipelines, we're going to ship that oil by rail, and there are even more risks associated with rail. But I think in many ways, though, the Keystone Pipeline and to a lesser extent the Dakota Access Pipeline have become heavily symbolic issues. So it's not surprising that environmental groups immediately denounced the president, the Sierra Club, the 350.org, which is Bill McKibben's group. They said they will fight the decisions. Fossil fuel companies have been on the side of the pipeline for the same reasons. Both sides have been pretty adamant. Some will recall we had the same battles over the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and eventually we moved away from that. So the outcome is not clear yet. Trump wants to accelerate the approval process, but there may well be lawsuits. There may well be further delays. It's pretty clear, however, we're going to see an acceleration in domestic production of oil and gas, almost certainly, because the Obama administration had slowed that down. So the pipeline is part of a larger picture of accelerated use of fossil fuels.
And we had been seeing accelerating production in the U.S. and Canada, for that matter, of oil that used to be harder to get, oil that used to be beyond our technology to pump out and process. That has been a big game changer, whether you're for or against the use of fossil fuels in our energy outlook, hasn't it?
Absolutely. The reliance on fracturing of shale or fracking has produced not only oil, but a lot of natural gas. And so we have an abundant and cheap supply of energy and natural gas. That's really what is done in coal mining and the use of coal, is that it's no longer competitive. Moreover, wind power has now dropped so much in a number of Midwestern states, including Illinois and Iowa, wind power is now cheaper without subsidies than any other source of fuel, including natural gas, that is for producing electricity. So, in many ways, we're in the midst of an energy revolution that's going in different directions than I think people would have estimated even 5 years ago. Wind and solar are rapidly gaining market share. But the positive side of fracturing of shale, and of course many people don't care for it, is that it has greatly increased domestic production of oil, which has meant a steep drop in the importation of oil. So we're closer to that elusive goal that was talked about so much in the 1970s of energy independence of oil. It makes us less dependent on oil from the Middle East and other parts of the world.
Talking to Michael Kraft, Emeritus Professor at UW-Green Bay, about energy policy in the United States and the announcement, the signings by Donald Trump of executive orders and memoranda that would advance two controversial pipelines, Keystone XL and the Dakota Access Pipeline. Michael, you've got a piece coming out later this week, I believe, on the wider issue of our energy portfolio, and you see a shift going on. I think that's no surprise to anyone, but you were hopeful hopeful about kind of a wider net on our energy supply previous to this. What did you see?
I'm hopeful because increasingly the energy market is going in a direction, I think, that Donald Trump as president and the Congress under the control of the Republican Party are not going to be able to change as much as they think. First of all, of course, we have the Paris Agreement on climate change, and almost all countries in the world have signed it, close to 200. That's going to mean nations are committed to reducing greenhouse gas emissions, which, of course, come from the production of use of fossil fuels. But there's been an enormous change in energy efficiency, vehicle fuel economy. So, as I noted, solar and wind power are becoming much more competitive. Companies as well as governments are eager to move in this direction. So in the larger scheme of things, this I see as a temporary setback. And I think even Republicans and the Trump administration may come to realize that you can create jobs through wind power and solar power as well. Trump mentioned 28,000 jobs will be created. Well, most of those are in construction. Once the pipeline is done, those jobs are gone. But wind power is likely to provide much more continuous employment over time because of the continued maintenance that would be required for wind turbines. So it's too simplistic to say fossil fuels are the way to go. We're about 80% dependent on fossil fuels, and if we care at all about climate change, we simply have to move in a different direction.
Yeah, staying on the jobs issue, do you see, alternative energy, I think, used to be seen, maybe still is seen as a priority on the left. Do you think that the idea that, hey, maybe there's jobs there would make it more of a bipartisan issue?
I think it would if people actually understood that. And the latest studies, I mentioned them in the editorial that's coming out this week, over time, the employment will increase, economic growth will increase. There have been some fascinating studies by the Brookings Institution at the state level that show that decarbonization, that is moving away from fossil fuels, does not at all inhibit economic growth. But some people are still stuck in the mindset of the 70s and 80s. They assume you can only have economic growth if you rely more and more on fossil fuels. And if you cut back on energy or become more efficient, it hurts the economy. The opposite is the case today because of changing technologies and new efficiencies.
Digging into the pipelines more specifically now, both of these, the Keystone XL, President Obama wouldn't issue a permit there.
Yes.
Dakota Access Pipeline suspended by the Army Corps of Engineers. They said further analysis is needed, looking at alternate routes. What do you see as the next steps now that we've got this new administration that's more favorable to these pipelines?
Well, there'll be a new proposal from Canada, I assume, for either the same or a slightly different Keystone pipeline that will have to go through similar review procedures, which can take a while, particularly if a new environmental impact statement has to be produced. The Dakota Access Pipeline, as you indicated, it was the Army Corps of Engineers, not the White House, that put a halt to it. And what they said is we'd like to give consideration to a different route that's a little bit farther away from the reservation and doesn't pose the risk of a pipeline failure into the river. And so the Army, I'm sure, would be receptive, Army Corps of Engineers, receptive to a new proposal, but that would have to go through a review. So I don't think we're going to see a decision in weeks or even months. This could take 6 months to a year for a review. And environmentalists will have their chance to speak up and, of course, to file lawsuits if they believe that the procedure has not been fair or adequate.
We're talking to Michael Kraft from UW Green Bay about the news that President Trump signed executive orders advancing the Keystone XL and Dakota Access pipelines.
We're taking your calls now at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this news? Are you happy that the president is moving forward to have these two pipelines built? Or do you worry about the environmental impact if the pipelines go forward? Call now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're picking up our discussion now with Michael Kraft, Public and Environmental Affairs Emeritus Professor at UW Green Bay. And we're talking about the news that President Trump has signed executive orders that would advance the Keystone XL and the Dakota Access pipelines today.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think? Do you want either or both of these pipelines to move forward? Do you think they're good for the American economy? Or do you worry about environmental risks outweighing economic benefit? Are you happy President Trump is in support of building these pipelines? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to our callers now. Dan is with us in Platteville. Dan, hi.
Yes, hello. My question, comment, question. I guess it's just kind of a hypothesis, and maybe this might not be as true as I would like to believe. Well, first of all, we're going to be using oil for a while. I mean, it's just something that we're just going to have to embrace. And I was wondering, but if we are able to get these pipelines built, and then the oil is flowing through a pipeline, yes, you got to make sure you factor in, is it going to be safe for wildlife, groundwater? But if we can get oil going through pipelines, instead now it's all going through rail or truck traffic. And if it's going through the pipeline, if we take the burden off the rail industry and the truck industry, particularly the rail industry, and allow other products to be moved by rail more, won't that actually in some ways, at least marginally, it kind of improve the environment or improve our dependency on fossil fuels?
Dan, thanks for the call. I get where you're going. Is it more energy efficient to move oil by pipeline than by truck or train? Well, it's safer, too, people say.
I think the key thing is it's safer. I mean, pipelines do have leaks occasionally, and opponents usually cite spectacular leaks. But we've had even more rail car disasters, rail cars carrying oil that threaten human life. And we had a major accident in Canada just a few years ago. So I think Dan is correct. If we're going to use oil, and even if we agree we should cut back on the oil we use, it's still got to come from somewhere, better that it's domestic than imported, or better from Canada and the U.S. And if you're going to ship it, maybe a pipeline is better. So then the question is, how do you make sure the pipeline is safe enough that you absolutely minimize the risk of spills, particularly in the water bodies or in a way that may cause a fire that could damage human life? Over time, the longer picture is we ought to cut back on oil, though we will be dependent on oil and natural gas for a very, very long time.
And thanks for the call, Dan. One of the objections to pipelines from environmentalists and others is that they would say it's enabling us to keep depending on fossil fuel in the future. Do you think there's anything to that?
Well, sure. I guess it's enabling in some sense, and there's been a particular concern about the kind of oil that would come through the Keystone XL pipeline, Canadian tar sands oil, which is argued to be somewhat worse for climate change. And I absolutely agree. Climate change is, and here I guess I would differ with President Trump, climate change is a major, major threat, both environmental threat and a national security threat to the world, and I hope the country doesn't reverse course on climate change. But we're 80% dependent on fossil fuel. We are likely to be 75 to 80% dependent anyway in 10 or 20 years, even with the gains in energy efficiency that I noted. But we need to start moving in that direction. So I'm equally upset that the Trump administration is about to pull back on auto fuel economy standards that Obama set. He met with auto leaders today, and that is certainly on the agenda, and Congress would have to go along. So we need to keep on the track toward energy efficiency, for developing renewable resources. Those produce just as many jobs, just as much economic gain, but at least it begins to put us on a path toward less reliance on fossil fuels.
Back to our callers now with Gary on the line in Boscobel. Gary, hi.
Thank you for taking my call. I spent a lot of time in the sand hills of Nebraska in an old farmhouse that I use out there, and that XL pipeline will go within a half a mile of that house. The sand hills in Nebraska are an incredibly fragile landscape, prone to being eroded by wind erosion, and that pipeline will go right over top of the Ogallala Aquifer. And of course, we've all covered the hazards of contamination of these pipelines rupturing. To me, it doesn't matter whether it's in a train and the train crashes and catches on fire or it leaks into the streams. All these hydrocarbons are going to be released into the atmosphere. Millions and millions of barrels of them, and it's all going to be based on economic gain. And in the end, all of humanity is going to suffer for this, and the villains are going to be the capitalists who have taken all this money, all this oil, and forced us to consume it and given us very little, if any, choices on how we can live our lives.
Gary, thanks for the call. Michael.
Yeah. Well, of course, the opposition to the Keystone Pipeline in Nebraska and other states close to the route were major factors in Obama's rejection of it. And I think people in those states can still protest and argue that the pipeline ought to take a different route and obviously urge that extra precautions be taken. I guess in the larger scheme of things, I would prefer that any pipeline not go anywhere near a water body or an aquifer for the risk that Gary describes. And I guess I agree with him also. And as I said, in the long term, I think all of us need to be quite attentive to the way we use and particularly waste fossil fuels, whether it's oil or natural gas. Energy efficiency and minimizing use, because eventually burning fossil fuels is the primary factor behind climate change. And climate change is going to be far, far worse for us. Not next year, not in 5 or 10 years, but in 40 or 50 years. And that's something that people need to think much more about.
Gary, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Michael Kraft, Emeritus Professor of Public and Environmental Affairs at UW-Green Bay, looking at oil and pipelines as President Trump has signed various memoranda and executive orders starting to pave the way for construction of the Keystone XL pipeline, potentially the Dakota Access Pipeline, which had been canceled or on hold in the previous administration. Back to our callers now. Janet is with us in Oconomowoc. Janet, hi.
Hello there. I feel really sad that we don't have a government that's visionary enough to say, yes, you know, our dependence on fossil fuel will have to change because we're going to run out. It's going to be harder and harder to extract. And we should be looking into wind and solar, and we're not. So basically, we're giving away hundreds of thousands of jobs to China because they're pursuing it. I have solar panels, and solar panels from China could beat anything that the U.S. produced. And so eventually, we'll have given all that away.
Janet, thanks for the call. Michael, we've had, you know, arms races and the space race. Is there an alternative energy race going on?
There is, and China's winning it, as Janet said. China's been on this route for at least a decade, and it's a major reason, that country's efforts are a major reason why the prices have plummeted for solar energy. And I think they'll fall a good deal more. But, you know, you don't ship wind turbines around the world because they're too big and heavy. And that's why I emphasize the job creation potential of wind turbines, because they can be made right in the state that's going to use them. You really don't want to ship them that far because of the size and weight. And that could be a way to job creation. And as I noted, the latest studies are telling us that economic growth does not depend on using carbon-based fuels, but decarbonization can result in just as robust a level of economic growth and employment, if not more so, than fossil fuels. Now, nobody's saying, in 5 years, we've got to drop all fossil fuels, or at least very few people are saying that. But you've got to have a plan, and you've got to be on a path, and that's what I've argued in the editorial. These issues have become so partisan and polarized in recent years that we have a case here with Donald Trump of, elections do have consequences. And because the parties are so divided on energy and climate change, switching from a Democrat to Republican gives you a whole new set of energy priorities. If that's not what people want, then they can take whatever action they deem appropriate. And, of course, you can try to persuade conservatives that they really need to rethink the reliance that this country and the world has on fossil fuels and give alternative energy or clean energy technologies a second look. And, of course, there's nuclear power. Many people taking this position say maybe we need to at least keep the nuclear reactors we now have running for a while longer until we get better clean energy sources to complement wind and solar and better battery technology and all of that. And that's the path I want us to be on. I want state and local government, the federal government, private entrepreneurs, utility companies, all to be pushing us in that direction, not to backtrack at this point.
Briefly, as we wrap up, Michael, we've seen this action on pipelines. You mentioned fuel economy standards may be up for a change. What else are you watching for, hoping for, or worrying about?
I'm worried that the Clean Power Plan is going to go away. The Clean Power Plan was Obama's long-developed EPA regulation that gives states about 15 years to move away from coal-fired electric power plants to natural gas or efficiency or solar or wind. They have a number of options. Every state can devise its own plan. Wisconsin is pretty heavily dependent on coal, and we have not done much with clean power. Trump presumably, and the Republicans in Congress will do away with the Clean Power Plan. If there's good news there, is that the fuel economy rules and the Clean Power Plan are formal regulations, and you can't, you know, there's no executive order to overturn those. You've got to start all over again with an alternative plan. By most accounts, that takes anywhere from 2 to 4 years, and there will be lawsuits along the way trying to do that.
We'll leave it there.
Some hope.
We'll leave it there for now, Michael. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Sure. Happy to be here.
That's Michael Kraft, Emeritus Professor at UW Green Bay, looking at Donald Trump's announcements about pipelines today and the future of American energy policy.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.